So once again we come to our great ancestor, Yuan Wu. This letter is called Washed Clean. He says, in visiting enlightened teachers and questioning them, you must see real nature and awaken to truth. As you directly forget feelings and put an end to views, you are inwardly washed clean. You become like a simpleton, not calculating gain and loss, not contending for superiority. Favorable or adverse, you cut everything off and don't let it continue. After a long time at this, you naturally arrive at the stage where there are no contrived activities and no concerns. Once again, it would be wonderful to hear, to be able to read the letter that was written to Yuan Wu for that gave rise to this response. Seemingly, it must have been from someone who was progressed within his practice a fair amount and is now honing or refining his insight by visiting different centers, which was the tradition at that time. Not so much now, but that's the way it was. So he gives some advice. As you directly forget feelings and put an end to views, you are inwardly washed clean. Now, of course, everybody practicing Zen for a while knows that this is it is futile to try to identify views and then check whether you're letting them go or not, and to start contending with this idea of forgetting all feelings. But to see into what really is underneath these statements, that basically he's talking about things that having to do with sustaining the idea of separation. Feelings, he's not referring to feelings that are the direct response to situations. The feeling of exhilaration, of a wind, a storm, meeting a friend, things like this. But rather the feelings that are the evaluative feelings, feelings about something. For these derive from a space of separation, from a judgmental place, from a place where an idea is being evaluated. For how can we evaluate life itself? Life itself, once we even speak of it, is an idea. So all feelings coming about this thing, life itself, or my life, or this, or the what happened today, and so on, are all about a story that is based on the process of selection of a group of ideas that have been linked together, and dropping away, the not paying attention to certain other ideas, which of course were equally a part of the fabric of one's life that day, but for inner reasons, that is, to substantiate a structure or something, they are neglected. They are deleted. And certain other ones are selected. And certain other things are distorted. A meaning is put on them that a person believes is true because it derives out of a belief structure that the person holds as having reality, and so on. All of this stuff is what he is saying here. Just pay no attention to that. Just allow it to drop away. This is what is meant by being washed clean. And not to think in terms of clean versus dirty or contaminated, but to see underneath what is meant by this. One does not pay attention. The being washed clean is not in reference to what some people who aren't familiar with the depth of the practice of Zen will speak of the kleshas, the defilements they call them. But fundamentally, from a Zen viewpoint, we know that there are no defilements. These are just ideas. There are no dirty things that have to be washed off. But washed clean refers to becoming pure. That is to say, there's only one thing here. It's not all kinds of things. And everything is a manifestation of this one thing. And that comes about from dropping away reliance upon beliefs and evaluative feelings about things and all of that. That's what he's referring to. When he says you become like a simpleton, not calculating gain and loss, not contending for superiority, he doesn't mean that we drop away our intelligence. But there's a certain simplicity about a person who is what we call a simpleton. There's not the complexities. There's simply a one-to-one response to the situation at hand. And in that degree, he's referring to the behavior as like that of a simpleton. Again, it would be pointless to say, well, what are we supposed to do then? Drop away all our intelligence? This is misunderstanding. So always go underneath. Give the writer, the Zen master, the benefit of the doubt, and just go underneath and say there must be something else being referred to here. And discern that, let it resonate with you. So favorable or adverse, cut everything off and don't let it continue. Clearly this is a manner, this is a style of words. For you know that if you try to cut something off, this is based upon an evaluation that it is a bad thing, an interfering thing, a not good thing, as something that is contrary to the path, the way, and so on. So there is not this cutting off. And there is not letting it continue, which implies a watchfulness for watching this particular thing continuing. And then doing something, putting a line through it, or stopping it somehow. It is rather being indifferent to it. And the basis of this indifference is knowing that all these things are innocent. They are not referring to a self. They arise as a result of causes and conditions, whether they be generated, as we say, on the inside, the feelings, the thoughts, the motivations, the words, and so on, or if they are generated on the outside, the various stimuli that arrive to our being from the world. They all arise as a result of causes and conditions, and none of them refers to a self. None of them is bad, none of them is good. So to have that witness quality to all of one's orientations towards these particular things, if you do so, as he says, after a long time you naturally arrive at a stage where there are no contrived activities and no concerns. What does this mean? It means that underneath one has really returned to the sense of the trust in oneself. Not oneself as against something, not oneself as an idea. But that it is enough to align with this process and to trust this process of the arising and falling away within this island of consciousness, which, if we want to put a word on it, we could call it I. But it is no different from the I of Buddha, where he says, in heaven above and earth below, I am the only one. So it's looking underneath. It's not putting this I in reference to any of the created selves, but merely as a convenience of language to refer to something that cannot be grasped by words, but is the most intimate of all experiences. So, going on, he says, as soon as you have the slightest wish to be unconcerned, a concern has already arisen. We know this is what I was referring to. Once one wave goes into motion, myriad waves follow. When will it ever stop? When death comes upon you in that condition, you will be frantic and confused simply because you are not free and clear. So again, he's arguing to this person to be mindful about the subtleties of the arising of differentiation, the arising of things that we make real by attending to them, by making them important, by making evaluations of supportive and unsupportive, good and bad, and so on. to just notice that with kindness and indifference. Kindness, because that aspect of love is an inclusive response, an inclusive emotional relationship to these things. It is not love in the sense of cherishing and wanting, but a love in the sense of there's no need to consider any of these things enemies or things to contend with. It's giving everything its own life, part of the essence of loving anyone or anything. So, he says, just make this work sure and true, and naturally, even in a noisy marketplace, it will be silent and still as water. Why worry, then, that you will not accomplish your task? And again, the idea that people have that there is something to accomplish before death, that there is something that is, one could be in error, or one could fail at accomplishing. One puts one's whole being into whatever is the karmic circumstance at hand, and everything else follows. It does not need to be made part of a structure, nor the significance of one's life be the result of having accomplished this and that and this and that, having completed some pattern. That's fine and good. And it's okay as a goal. It's a wonderful thing. It arises. It has given rise to many wonderful things. But don't identify. Don't identify with it, Rob. Don't make it that you're not okay unless you accomplish or fulfill these particular goals. One has to have the kind of indifference to the accomplishment of these things that a person can have when there is no identification with them. So, finally, he says in this letter, as soon as there is affirmation and negation, this is in quotes, as soon as there is affirmation and negation, the mind is lost in confusion. You may recognize that as a line from the Shinjin Ming. So as soon as you give rise to this and that, affirmation and negation, the mind immediately goes into confusion. It has to make decisions. It has to put things into a hierarchical relationship, one with the other. It has to do all kinds of complexities, all about something that has no substance. It's all a creation of our minds, a tribute to the creativity that we are, a tribute to the fact that we are God in the sense that God is the creator. We are merely manifesting that activity, which sometimes resides solely within the thought realm, and those thoughts can result also in behavior, and then they can result in material manifestation of things. And is it all the result of this innate creative activity of a human being, unique in each island? But not to identify. This is the whole problem that we want to face as we're practicing Zen. How many people, he says, have been started by this statement into making judgments and arguments? If you cut them off at the start, you penetrate through to the other side of the primordial Buddha. In other words, if you don't let the Velcro take root, you don't let it get stuck to you, you don't let yourself take that initial step of identifying with these things. I am the one who. So on. If you follow these words along, you will be even more confused. To get it, you have to turn your own light around and look back. In Zen, you often see it said by a master giving directives on the practice of Zazen, is that the idea is to look and find where do the thoughts come from. That's what we're talking about here, by turning your light around and looking back. Don't wait until they have been generated and they've started to proliferate and starting to connect with superiority and inferiority and adverse and favorable and all the rest of it. But whence did they arise? Where did they come from? looking back like that. As we used to say, it's like the injunction that folks were given during the Civil War to fire as soon as you saw the whites of their eyes. Maybe not a good image, but it's a matter of not waiting for the time when the mind gets already confused and involved. But what is a thought, really? Whence did it arise? What is this feeling? How did it come about? What's its source? What's its root? What is it? And looking at that area is a very vital and alive process that does not engage the differentiation-bound mind. And this is a process of, as he calls it, washing clean. Now let's look at another short letter here. This is called Self and Things. He says, all the myriad things are neither opposed to nor contrary to your true self. Directly pass through to freedom and they make one whole. It has been this way from time without beginning. That's another fact of Zen. It is not so much negating the time-based reality. It is realizing the wonderful function of time-based reality, the necessity even of time-based reality for us to operate in the samsaric structure of the world that is our domain. But in order to become free, in order to live from one's essential nature, one must, as he says, turn towards the place from which all these things arise, and where you will find it is the place before. And a place before means before we've added all these things, and it is a place, as it's often stated here, of time without beginning. Time without beginning. To experience directly is to go beyond the elaborations that create time. So it is becoming more and more like a flame that is not blown by any wind. Any wind of thought. But it is poised, as it were. That's what he meant in the previous letter by, if you practice this, even in the busy marketplace, your mind is as still as still water. And this, of course, is something to practice if you are in a busy place. It could be anywhere. It could be a mall. It could be your business place. Take a moment. Just witness all that. It is merely the fabric of things rising and falling. Simply the fabric of karma. Voices, actions. They arise, they fall away, they transform, so on. Whereas in the middle of it, you can remain still. And by still, I mean not still as opposed to something, not a stillness that you have to forcibly create, but it's recognizing an innate stillness in one that is equal to spaciousness. It is equal to embracing. It is equal to being larger than all that is going on around you. You contain it, just as space contains all things. Going on, he says, the only problem is when people put themselves in opposition to it and spurn it, and they pose orientations of grasping or rejecting, creating a concern where there is none. This is precisely why they are not joyfully alive. We might say the world is just upside down. It pursues happiness. It pursues joy. It pursues the aggrandizement of itself. And this pursuit is, as the Shinshin Ming says, creating waves where there is no wind. He says if you can cut off outward clinging to objects and inwardly forget your false ideas of self, things themselves are the true self, and the true self itself is things. Things and the true self are one suchness, opening through to infinity. That reminds one, does it not, of that wonderful classic statement of Zen Master Dogen, where he says to study Buddhism is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to abandon the idea of body and mind, of self and other, and to do that is to be aligned, is to be enlightened by all things. When you drop away, as he points out, this attitude of clinging to objects and clinging to a self and evaluating and all these sorts of things, when these are quietened, you just notice them. As he says in the previous letter, if you practice this for a long time, gradually these come to stillness. They no longer engage one. One observes them, one can utilize them, these evaluations if necessary, and so on. But they don't engage one, they don't grasp one, they don't run one's life. They become tools, they become resources. But they are not who you are. And they are not sitting in the driver's seat. And when that happens, you engage with things. Things engage with you. You become aware of things. Things, whether they be internally generated or externally. This is partly the story of the Buddha holding up the flower in that assembly on Vulture Peak, and Kashyapa being the only one that smiled. That smile of recognition of just this. Just this. It happened to be a flower, which is in a sense too bad. Because people naturally think flowers are this special, beautiful thing. But it could have been a stone. It could have been anything. And as Zen Master Umon wonderfully put in that koan in the Mumon Kan, where someone asks about Buddha, and Zen Master Umon says, dried shit. Anything that is attended to in that way, without evaluation, without making it part of a structure, without relating it to a self, without grasping, without pushing away, but just it itself becomes a gateway, becomes an opening. An opening to what? An opening to that which is before time, before the ideas of self even arose. It is an opening, as Yuan Wu said, just a few paragraphs back, to the primordial Buddha. That is to say, our own fundamental nature. After all the accretions of time and space have been dropped away by assiduous practice. So he goes on, then at all times, whatever you may be doing, it stands like a mile-high wall. Where is all the trouble and disturbance? A mile-high wall. Who could avoid that? You can't neglect a wall that is a mile high. It just stands before you and is unavoidable. So it is with fundamental nature. When the habit of evaluating and judging and grasping pushing away and all those sorts of things, when they have dropped away, they have ceased to engage one. They may arise, they may not arise, but they don't engage one, they don't grab you, they don't drive your life. Then the world opens everywhere. And it is recognized, this fundamental nature that is always there, does not have to be created, does not have to be manufactured. It's simply always there. And over one demonstrates, one proves to oneself the fundamental teaching of Zen. That it is these accretions that we identify with. And this can include Buddhism. So many people are deluded by Buddhism, by the idea of this ism, by the idea of stages, by the idea of grasping something, by the idea of how we should live, and all that sort of thing. Yet this comes out of blindness. Zen is so radical. No wonder Tosan came down from the north to the south to the place where these Zen Buddhists were proclaiming that one can go directly without sutras and without rituals into an awakening of this fundamental reality of this, one can become Buddha. No wonder he came down to put these people in their place. Unfortunately met Ryutan, who enabled him to drop away what was in his way by holding so tightly to this idea that the only way to reality was through this way of knowledge, and so on. So he says, time and again, I see long-time Zen students who have been freezing their spirits and letting their perceptions settle out and clarify for a long time. Though they have entered the way, they immediately accepted a single device or a single state, and now they rigidly hold on to it and won't allow it to be stripped away. This is truly a serious disease. And in Zen, there is the idea that there are diseases of the mind. Of course, there are diseases of the mind of all sorts. Diseases of believing and living by that which has no substance. But also after awakening, he says, although they have entered the way, they are profoundly susceptible to various diseases. And one of them is to be attached to and put a package, or to package and put a little wall around or a ribbon around a thing that they call enlightenment, and thus bar themselves from this very fundamental life-giving thing. It has been made into a thing, and like all these things that the mind creates, it has no substance. Bring forth this enlightenment that you put the ribbon around. Where is it? And people piously hold on to these sorts of things. Or, you know, do other things, take names that are different from the name that they had when they were born, put on fancy clothes, robes, shave their head, on it goes. Different ways of becoming a professional self for the sake of this empty distinction. We see it all the time. Yuan Wu talks about it from the Song Dynasty. It happens throughout all of time because of this human tendency to be so hungry for the self that it's willing to settle for anything, and especially a glorious thing. Surely I have arrived. Surely this is the answer. And to have the discipline within oneself to realize any time you say that, you have closed your eyes. You learn what this divine indifference is that is the animating life of the practice of Zen. This is not a callous indifference. It is a living, alive thing that is perceptive. It is not to be fooled. And at the same time, it allows life to arise out of the cracks in the concrete. So Yuan Wu finally says, to succeed, it is necessary to melt and let go and spontaneously attain a state of great rest. And that really says it. Melt. Melt all your structures. Let go. Without questioning who is letting go of what. Find what is meant by let go. As soon as it comes in, wants to grab you, you just feel the little touch of the Velcro. the little contraction of a being into a self. The result is, spontaneously, one attains a state of great rest. Rest of what? The rest from the burdensome activity, as the Shenzhen Ming says. That little document contains so much. But the Shenzhen Ming speaks of the burdensome activity of judging. It goes to rest. This is to learn what the real practice of Zen is. And this is to use every moment as an entryway into life. For that is what Zen is all about. It is not about becoming a Buddhist or becoming an expert on any of the sutras. It is about learning over and over, time after time, what is the essence of living, and practicing that in circumstances which others may call adverse, or whatever they may call them. But your orientation as a sincere practitioner of the way of Zen is utilizing everything to not be fooled and to come to this great state of, you might say, living rest, enlivened rest. What a paradox, enlivened rest. This is not the rest of lying in a lounge chair on the beach in Florida, though it could be found there too. The resting of this mind activity. No longer do you have to construct a life, a mind, a thought, a self. That coming to rest. And from that, this is the place that fertilizes the seeds of life in whatever circumstances one is. This is the great way of Zen. We'll end there tonight.